Chapter 15. The lines mentioned in the last chapter did arrest my attention. I read them again and again. My interest for reading novels and romances ceased from that hour. Among the many books, I selected Doddridge's Rise and Progress of Religion in the Soul. This and the Bible now interested me more than all other books. Christopher Christofferson of Norway, one of my crew, was taken down sick soon after our departure from Cape Henry. Nothing in our medicine chest availed to relieve him. His case appeared more and more dreadful. The first verse of The Hour of Death, particularly the fourth line, was almost continually in my mind. Thou hast all seasons for thine own, O death. I longed to be a Christian, but the pride of my heart and the vain allurements of the wicked world still held me with a mighty grasp. I suffered intensely in my mind before I decided to pray. It seemed as though I had delayed this work too long. I was also afraid that my officers and men would learn that I was under conviction. Furthermore, I had no secret place to pray. When I look back on some of the incidents in my past life, how God had interposed His arm to save me, when death was staring me in the face again and again, and how soon I had forgotten all His mercies, I felt then I must yield. Finally, I decided to try the strength of prayer and confess all my sins. I opened the run scuttle under the dining table where I prepared a place so that I might be out of the sight of my officers, if they should have occasion to enter the cabin during my prayer season. The first time I bowed the knee in prayer, it seemed to me that the hair on my head was standing out straight for presuming to open my mouth in prayer to the great and holy God. But I determined to persevere until I found pardon and peace for my troubled mind. I had no Christian friend at hand to tell me how or how long I must be convicted before conversion. But I remember when I was a lad, during the Great Reformation of 1807 in New Bradford and Fairhaven, of hearing the converts, when relating their experience, say that they had been sorrowing for sin 2 or 3 weeks, when the Lord spake peace to their minds. It seemed to me that my case would be something similar. A fortnight passed, and no light beamed on my mind. 1 week more, and still my mind was like the troubled sea. About this time I was walking the deck in the night, and was strongly tempted to jump overboard and put an end to myself. I thought this was a temptation of the devil, and immediately left the deck and did not allow myself to go out of my cabin again until the morning. Christopher was very sick and failing. It occurred to me that if he should die, I should be doubly earnest about my salvation. I now removed him into the cabin and placed him in a berth next to my own, where I could give him more attention, and charged the officers as they waited upon him during their night watch to call me if they saw any change in him. I woke in the morning soon after daylight. My first thought was, how is Christopher? I reached over his berth and placed my hand on his forehead, and it felt cold. He was dead. I called the officer of the morning watch. "Why, Mr. Hafford," said I, "Christopher is dead. Why did you fail to call me?" Said Mr. H., "I was down to him about half an hour ago and gave him his medicine and saw no alteration then." Poor C. was now laid out on the quarter-deck and finally sewed up in a hammock with a heavy bag of sand at his feet. After we had settled on the time to bury him, I was most seriously troubled in relation to my duty. I felt that I was a sinner in the sight of God, and dare not attempt to pray in public. And yet I could not consent to plunge the poor fellow into the ocean without some religious ceremony over him. While I was resolving in my mind what I should do, the steward asked me if I would not like to have a Church of England prayer book. "Oh, yes," said I. "Have you got one?" "Yes, sir." "Bring it to me, will you?" It was just the book I wanted, for when I was in the British service, I had heard the ship's clerk read prayers out of such a book when our sailors were buried. but this was the first burial at sea that ever occurred under my command. I opened the book and found a suitable prayer for the occasion. A plank was prepared with one end over the side of the vessel on which his body was laid, with his feet toward the sea, so that by rising the other end of the plank the body would slide into the ocean feet foremost. All but the helmsman stood around poor Christopher to take their final leave of him and commit his body to the deep as soon as the order should be given. The idea of attempting to perform religious service over the dead, while in an unconverted state, troubled me much. I had requested the chief mate to call me when he had made the preparation and retired below. When the officer reported all ready, I came up trembling, with the book open in my hand. The crew respectfully uncovered their heads. As I began to read, my voice faltered, and I was so unmanned I found it difficult to read distinctly. I felt, indeed, that I was a sinner before God. When I finished the last sentence, I waved my hand to tip the plank and turned for the cabin. As I passed down the gangway, I heard poor Christopher plunge into the sea. I passed down into my praying place and vented my feelings in prayer for the forgiveness of all my sins and those of the poor fellow that was sinking lower and lower beneath the rolling waves. This was the 30th of September, 26 days from the Capes of Virginia. From thence I felt a sinking into the will of God, resolving henceforward to renounce the unfruitful works of the enemy, and seek carefully for eternal life. I believe now that all my sins were forgiven about that time. Then I also made the following covenant with God, which I found in Doddridge's Rise and Progress of Religion in the Soul. A Solemn Covenant with God. Quote, Eternal and ever-blessed God, I desire to present myself before Thee with the deepest humiliation and abasement of soul. Sensible how unworthy such a sinful worm is to appear before the holy majesty of heaven, the King of kings and Lord of lords, I come therefore acknowledging myself to have been a great offender, smiting on my breast and saying with the humble publican, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. This day do I with the utmost solemnity surrender myself to Thee. I renounce all former lords that have had dominion over me, and I consecrate to Thee all that I am and all that I have. Use me, O Lord, I beseech Thee, as an instrument of Thy service. Number me among Thy peculiar people. Let me be washed in the blood of Thy dear Son, to whom with Thee, O Father, be everlasting praises ascribed by all the millions who are thus saved by Thee. Amen. Close quote. Done on board the brig Empress of New Bedford at sea, October 4, 1824, in latitude 19 degrees 50 minutes north, longitude 34 degrees 50 minutes west, bound to the Brazils, Joseph Bates, Jr. I wish that I could always have the resignation to the will of God that I felt the morning that I signed this covenant. Yet I could not believe then, nor for many months after this, that I had any other feelings than a deep conviction for sin. I am satisfied that I have not always regarded this covenant in the solemn light in which I now understand it. But I am very glad I made it, and that God has still spared my life to allow me yet to do all that I therein covenanted to do. After signing the aforementioned covenant, I had a remarkable dream respecting some communications from the post office. One appeared to be written on a roll of paper, the other a long letter commencing with spaces as follows: Examine, examine, examine. Experience, experience, experience. Yourself, yourself, yourself. Then followed a long letter commencing with religious instruction, closely written, of which I read a few lines when I awoke. I then wrote it on paper and filed it with other papers, but it is now missing. There was much more which I have forgotten, but I believe the dream thus peculiarly set forth on paper was to convince me that my sins were forgiven. But I failed to see it then, because I had conceived that God would manifest himself in such a manner that I should never doubt my conversion afterwards. I had not then learned the simplicity of God's gracious work on the sinner's heart. It would have been a great relief to me if I could have been released from the heavy responsibilities of my trading voyage, considering how my mind was then exercised. But our voyage continued, and we arrived at Pernambuco October 30th. There we found the state of commerce was very far from prosperous in relation to our voyage. But we were now at the best market for selling. We therefore disposed of our cargo. I was much disappointed also in not finding one professor of religion to converse with among the many thousands of people here, but I was fully resolved to persevere for a full and free salvation. Pernambuco in Brazil is situated on the border of the sea. On approaching it from the ocean, it has a commanding and beautiful appearance. But the shipping have to anchor in the open sea some distance from the land, and on account of the heavy surf on the shore, it is difficult getting safe to land. Captain Barrett from Nantucket, Massachusetts, arrived at this port soon after us. Concluding to sail here also, he sent his boat off to bring his wife on shore. As the boat with Mrs. B. was drawing in with the shore, quite a number of us assembled near the landing place with Captain B. to receive her. A number of black slaves were also waiting, whose business it was to wade out to the boats and shoulder freight and passengers, if possible, bear them safely through the breakers to the landing. The fare through the breakers for a passenger without stumbling was 1 real, or 12.5 cents. It was soon decided who should have the honor of bringing the American lady through the breakers. Captain B. requested his wife to seat herself upon the shoulder of the black man that was now in waiting for her. This was a mode of traveling that Mrs. B. was entirely unacquainted with. Besides, it was with her very doubtful whether the man could pass the breakers without being overwhelmed in the surf. Therefore, she hesitated and was silent. Captain B. and his friends urged, declaring there was no other mode of conveyance. Finally, she seated herself upon the shoulders and grasped him by the head with both hands, when he steadily and manfully bore her in safety to the arms of her husband in our midst, while his comrades raised a joyous shout in commendation of the sturdy and manful manner in which he had performed the act of landing the American lady. Here also, as in other places, I was assailed by my associates for refusing to drink wine or intoxicating drinks with them, especially wine at the dinner table, which was very common in South America. I will here give one instance. A large company of us were dining with the American consul, Mr. Bennett. His lady at the head of the table filled her glass and said, "Captain B., shall I have the pleasure of a glass of wine with you?" I responded and filled my glass with water. Mrs. B. declined unless I would fill my glass with wine. She was aware from our previous acquaintance that I did not drink wine, but she felt disposed to induce me to disregard my former resolutions. As our waiting position attracted the attention of the company, one of them said, "Why, Mr. Bates, do you refuse to drink to Mrs. Bennett's health in a glass of wine?" I replied that I did not drink wine on any occasion and begged Mrs. B. to accept my offer. She readily condescended and drank my health in the glass of wine and I hers in a glass of water. The topic of conversation now turned on wine drinking and my course in relation to it. Some concluded that a glass of wine would not injure anyone. True, but the person who drank one glass would be likely to drink another and another, until there was no hope of reform. Said one, "I wish I could do as Captain Bates does. I should be much better off." Another supposed that I was a reformed drunkard. Surely there was no harm in drinking moderately. I endeavored to convince them that the better way to do up the business was not to use it at all. On another occasion, one captain said to me, "Oh, you are like old Mr. Blank of Nantucket. He wouldn't drink sweetened water." After a stay of 6 weeks, having disposed of the greater part of our cargo in Pernambuco, we sailed on another voyage to St. Catharines, in latitude 27 degrees 30 minutes south. Care, an oppressive business, I perceived had in some measure deprived me of the spiritual enjoyment I possessed on my arrival at Pernambuco. I had more leisure just now to search the scriptures and read other books on the subject of religion. I here commenced a diary of my views and feelings, which was a great help to me. This I forwarded to my wife as often as I wrote to her. These sheets were bound up in a roll and laid by, and have not been read for about 35 years. I have supposed that this was one of the rolls of paper which I saw in the peculiar dream I had relative to my experience on my outward passage. I thought what a great privilege it would be to have just one professed Christian to compare my views and feelings with on this all-absorbing theme, or to be in a prayer meeting for an hour or so that I might vent the feelings that were pent up within me. We arrived at St. Catherine's about the 1st of January, 1825, where we purchased a cargo of provisions for the northern coast of Brazil. This island is separated from the mainland by a narrow ship channel. St. Catherine's is the only commercial seaport for hundreds of miles on the coast. Its northern promontory is a high mountain, where watchmen with their flagstaff planted were watching for whales in the offing. When the signal was given that whales were in sight, the boats from the fishery, some 10 or 12 miles distant, would row out for them, and if they were fortunate enough to harpoon and kill any, they would tow them to their try-works and manufacture them into oil. 50 years ago this business was very flourishing there, but the whales visit them so seldom since that time that their business has about ceased. When I left Pernambuco, the province was in a state of revolution and much in want of farina. It was expected that the Brazilian government would allow foreign vessels to trade in this article on the coast if the demand continued to increase as it had for a few months past. In anticipation of this, I proceeded to St. Catherine's and loaded for Pernambuco. As many of my readers may be unacquainted with this article of food, I would state that it is first cultivated very much like the Carolina sweet potatoes, and resembles them only being much longer. They mature in from 9 to 18 months, if not destroyed by frost, and are called mandioca. The process of manufacturing it into flour in their sheds or shanties was as follows. A cow harnessed at the end of a shaft, traveling in a circle, moved a wheel banded with copper, having holes pierced through it like a grater. A man with his tub of scraped mandioca pressed it end foremost against the whirling grater, which ground it to pumice, piece after piece. This pumice was then placed in a machine like a cheese press, and all the juice pressed out. Then the pumice was thrown into large shallow iron pans over a heated furnace, where in about 20 minutes 2 or 3 bushels were dried, and when taken out was put up for the market, and, I was told, would keep 3 years. This they call farina, or Brazilian flour. The general way of preparing it for the table was merely to scald it with hot soup in plates and pass it round for bread. The poorer classes and slaves gather it up with the ends of their fingers and throw it into their mouths by the half ounce and wash it down with water. At this time, much of it is imported into the United States and retailed at the stores. On my arrival at Pernambuco, farina was in good demand, but the government would not allow me to enter because it was unlawful for foreign vessels to trade coastwise. In a few days, a message came overland from a president of one of the northern provinces inviting me to come to the port of Pariba and dispose of my cargo. Here I sold my whole cargo at an advanced price, the government purchasing a large share of it for their troops. As the drought continued and my vessel was a fast sailer, the president granted me permission to import another cargo forthwith and gave me a letter of introduction to the president of St. Catherine's to help me onward. On my arrival at St. Catherine's, the merchants, learning about the demand for breadstuffs in the north, endeavored to prevent me from buying until they were ready to dispatch vessels of their own. After a few weeks' detention in this way, I employed an interpreter and proceeded in our boat some distance up the coast. Leaving our boat to return and come for us the next day, we went up into the mountains to purchase farina from the farmers. On some farms we found it by the roomful, bedroom or sitting room, just as they had places to stow it from the rain, for use and for sale. Some of their rooms were crowded and packed full with this article. The merchants in St. Catharines, hearing of our success in purchasing produce of the farmers and towing it to our vessels in boats, tried hard to prejudice them against us. But our silver paddocks of 40, 80, and 120 cent pieces, with which we paid them for their farina at the highest market price, was far superior to their barter traffic and proffered advice. The first night I spent on the mountain was a trying, sleepless one. I had 2 heavy bags of silver, and night had overtaken us at a house where we had made a purchase to be delivered in the morning. I said to the man through my interpreter, "Here are 2 bags of silver we have with us to buy farina. I want you to keep them safe for us until the morning." "Oh, yes," he replied, and stowed them away in a case.